Welcome to SD Europe's podcast. My name is Luke Cox. I lead SD Europe's communications. For this episode, we speak to Alan Russell, the CEO of SD Scotland, about how a growing number of Scottish football clubs are transitioning into fan ownership out of foresight rather than crisis. Usually, an owner cannot support a club financially anymore, and with no other private owners interested, supporters are left to pick up the pieces and take over the club after it goes bust. But in Scotland, a number of clubs are going through what's called a structured transition, a term coined by SD Scotland, where they go from private ownership into fan ownership, and where owners and organised democratic supporters groups work together to ensure the long-term stability of their football clubs. But that's enough from me. Let's get into it. So, Alan, first question, can you just give a brief summary of what the idea of a structured transition into fan ownership is? And this is a term that SD Scotland has coined, right?
Yeah, I guess it is. I mean, it's something I spotted that there was a bit of a pattern to what was happening at Scottish football clubs. And I wanted to write about it. I wanted to give it a name that I could remember so I could talk about it as being distinct from other things. So it's a term that we've coined up here to describe what's happened at a few clubs in Scotland. And really what it is it's a move for a club being under conventional, traditional ownership into fan ownership, but done in a way that doesn't have to come out of crisis, and it's not where the supporters are seen as the owner of last resort, which I think has been the case in the past in Scotland and elsewhere, is that clubs only really went into supporter ownership as a last resort when they were in crisis, when there was nobody else, you know, willing to take on the club and a way of keeping it alive. And what structured transitions are, it's a proactive step by an outgoing owner to say, well, I want to go into partnership with the supporters group in order to gradually move it into supporter ownership and give it the time to work and for it to be a lasting way of embedding their legacy in the club. So I think a couple of things about, you know, picking that name and the way we describe it. We're very kind of deliberate to describe it as something that's planned, something that's good for everybody. So it's good for the outgoing owner, it's good for the supporters group, and it's good for the future of the club. And also the fact that it's something that it's that sense of legacy. Because often we find ourselves talking about owners as if they're bad people. And actually, the vast majority of traditional owners of football clubs are really good people that have got the club at heart and want it to be left in good shape when they're gone. And this creates an opportunity for them to do that, and a bit of a template for getting there as well.
Mm. That's it. I think that's a good point about legacy, because I think, just from trying to sort of find a little bit more about it myself, it does seem it's a case where they've, you know, these traditional owners have realised the opportunity that's there to become a supporter-owned club. As opposed to, you say, you know, the sort of crisis situation where supporters are the last resort.
Yeah, I think the other thing that kind of struck me as I was talking to somebody, an owner of a football club, who's still the owner of a football club, a traditional owner, and he said to me, it's far easier to buy a football club than to sell a football club. And if you're reaching the end of your time or the end of your money and you want to sell it to somebody else, it's very, very difficult to buy, to find a good owner for it, a good buyer for that club. Whereas anybody with a bit of the gift of the gab can turn up and convince somebody that they're going to be a good owner. So it's very, very easy to buy a club. There's lots of them for sale, but it's harder to sell it to a good person, to the right person, when you want that to happen. And I think that stuck with me ever since hearing that description of it. And that's from somebody who you can say is broadly against supporter ownership, doesn't think it's a great idea, or certainly didn't back at the time. But they actually said, well, that's a problem for us owners. It's like, how do we find somebody to take on a club and keep on doing a great job the way that he's been saying, the way that I've been doing, the way that I want to do for the next few years? But when my time's up, how do I pass it on to somebody who's going to keep on doing a good job of it? So I think that's the other thing that drives the need for this new kind of way of doing it.
That's very true, actually, because I'm sure there's, you know, these traditional owners who are looking to sell their clubs, they're probably falling over offers from, you know, the people who think they can make a quick buck out of it. But to actually find a genuine steward of a football club is probably a lot more rare.
You'd think that, but they're right on their doorstep all the time, literally on their doorstep. It's the local community, it's the local support. Mm. They're there at every single club. If only they had a way of figuring out how to make it work without it being a risk to hand it over. And that's this idea of like a kind of a tapered handover from one owner to a collective ownership model.
So who was the first club to do this, and what triggered this sort of method of going through this sort of ownership conversion?
The example I always quote is the first one in Scotland, it's Hearts. And Hearts is a really interesting example, because back in 2013, what triggered it was exactly the opposite of what I've described. What triggered it was a crisis. What triggered it was the previous owner basically running out of money. The club, you know, was threatened with going out of existence. It wasn't just administration, it was potentially liquidation at Hearts. And that was back in 2013. The other interesting thing about Hearts is that in 2021, they're still in that transitionary period. They're still not supporter owned. A lot of people for the last 8 years have described Hearts as a fan owned club, but they're not fan owned yet. They're in this carefully structured model that will eventually deliver it into stable and secure and sustainable supporter ownership. So they're really the first one in Scotland. It's probably happened to a degree other clubs. So Clyde and Stirling Albion were supporter owned before Hearts hit the black ice back in 2013. But it wasn't done in quite the same way. It was more like a traditional transition into supporter ownership. The first one to actually get a long-term planned stable transition as a way of achieving that was at Hearts, where Anne Budge stepped in with deep enough pockets to keep things going, to get the club out of the woods, but then said her goal and her end state vision for it, always right from the word go, was that she would basically, you know, look after the club until the fans were ready. So she was the first one to put that kind of deal in writing. So right from the start, the Hearts fans had a plan. They had a, you know, I think it's probably as formal as a contract in place, that when they hit all these requirements, then that will trigger the transfer of the shareholding. So they were the first one to do it in Scotland 8 years ago. And that's the really interesting part of it, is it's 8 years down the line and they're ready to take over. It would have happened last year. It would have happened probably about 2 months after coronavirus lockdown began. That was when they were planning to do it. They put it on ice until after lockdown, and it's now planned for May of this year. So hopefully within 2 months, and they will have completed that transition period, you know, that's lasted for 8 years. And it's probably the longest plan that's ever been put in place to do it, and probably the most ambitious, because they're a massive club in terms of, you know, the number of supporters, the infrastructure they have. In the middle of that plan, which wasn't originally meant to take 8 years, they decided to rebuild the main stand. And the fans agreed that would be a good priority, something for them to work towards and help finance. So that delayed things. They've also done other projects around the side with their money. So it's not just been about share ownership. It's been about improving the stadium, improving the club's asset, improving the club's community projects. It's home for the fans, really.
Well, that's what I was about to ask. With Hearts, you said that last year they did actually have a sort of, not a deadline as such, but well, maybe call it a deadline. They were saying, right, we're going to work to this date. This is the agreed date. Yeah. And then obviously with the pandemic and whatnot, it delayed it. But was that something sort of hard set in stone, as far as you know, between the club?
It never had to happen at that date. It had to happen when they'd raised enough funds to pay off the last installment of the debt to Anne Budge. So she put working, she put a sum of money in, large sum of money in, and they were working to pay that off. And then once they paid the last installment of that, then the shares would be able to transfer across. So they made the last payment. I think it was probably February or March of last year, and they decided on a date to formally take on the share ownership. It was going to be a significant date in their history, and so they decided to do it on that date. It just happened that the world changed in between paying the last instalment and the planned kind of, you know, cutting the tape, if you like, smashing the bottle of champagne into the side of the stand. I don't know what it was that we're actually going to do.
So I'm just curious about this situation with Hearts. Is it sort of they'll become 100% support around? Is it just like sort of 51% just to get over the line? Or?
It's more than 51%. It's not 100%. I'm trying to remember now the exact figure. There are a lot of historical shareholders, and they'll remain shareholders for as long as they want to be shareholders. So the Foundation of Hearts will take over Bidco, which is the company that Anne Budge set up. They will take over the Bidco shareholding, which I think is around about 80 or 90%.
Oh, so it's that's a comfortable majority.
Maybe more than 90, in fact. But it's not 100%. But it's way beyond 51%. And it's the practical outright ownership, even if it's not 100%.
Yeah, there's sort of no disputing that. Yeah. Okay. And I think you've mentioned a couple of other clubs there. So how many clubs have gone through this process are going through this process at the moment?
Two have gone through that process already. And there's two more where there's kind of exploratory steps being taken. So the second one to happen, you know, through this kind of model was at St Mirren back in 2016. A guy called Gordon Scott, he invested money temporarily to buy over the working majority shareholding from outgoing shareholders, and had a plan in place with SMISA, the St Mirren Independent Supporters Association, that they would gradually take his shareholding over. And in the meantime, they would have a director on the board of the football club to basically learn the ropes. They structured it around, so every 2 years, another fan would come into the boardroom to get experience of being a director. So by the end of 5 years or 6 years or 8 years, however long it took, you know, several people would have had real experience of being part of decision making at the club and know exactly what it took to run the club. So they would work alongside Gordon Scott to basically be ready to take it over, and also in the meantime raise the money to do it. And then, you know, the handover of shares and would happen at the right time. In between then and now, I think it was in January of last year, there was a local charity called Kibble, who are a social care charity. They do a lot of things around, I think historically they ran a children's home, and they do a lot of things around education and employability in the local community. St Mirren and Kibble are probably two of the oldest institutions in the Paisley community. So they've got a long, long history with a footprint in that town. They're known to everybody, you know, for generations. Kibble last year offered to accelerate the transition to supporter ownership by taking a minority stake. So what it would mean is that I think the previous agreement, the St Mirren Independent Supporters Association, were going to take on about 70% of the shares. And Kibble said, if we take on that 20% and you just take on 51%, we'll stay as a minority shareholder. We'll have a seat on the board, but only one or maybe two seats on the board. You will always have majority shareholding. You'll also have the right to buy us out at any point in time if you want to. And we'll get you there in the next 18 months rather than the next 5 years, which was our plan at the time. So I think they're on track probably before the end of this year to take on that 51% shareholding from Gordon Scott, and then operate the club as majority shareholders with Kibble as a minority shareholder. I think with Gordon Scott still retaining a nominal shareholding, and then a load of local individual shareholders that will have a stake in the club as well. So that was in 2016 that they did that, and again it was a very deliberate. An individual said, I think you're the best model for this club as owners going forward. I'll help you get there, and I'll give you the time to be ready for it, to raise the money so you don't have to cut corners along the way, and also have the experience to run it. The next one after that was Motherwell. So Motherwell had done it. So I think it was in 2017. Again, it was a couple, maybe three shareholders decided to buy the majority stake and then work in partnership with the Well Society. What they did, they handed over control of the club to the Well Society straight away, and they retained a seat on the board as well. But the Well Society set up an operational board to run the club straight away, and they had an agreement with those other shareholders that would gradually pay back their debt to them over a few years. So Well Society were able to get their hands on the steering wheel straight away, start to run the club the way they want to. And the other way that the deal was structured was that the outgoing owners would take a share of any transfer fees received, I don't know if it's 50-50, but it's probably something like an equal share. Half can go into the club to run things, to develop new players, to improve the infrastructure, and half will go to pay off the outgoing shareholders. And last year, I think it was in February or March, they reached the milestone where the club was debt-free for the first time since the early 1980s.
Wow.
And it happened. So it happened when the club was in the Premiership. It had, I think, back-to-back third place finishes in the Premiership. So they were successful on the field. They were developing young players and selling them on for a good amount of money. And that's what got them, through that transition. So they had a period of, I guess, 3 years from 2017 to 2020 where they were getting ready. But the transition there was a financial transition. They operated the club as if they were owners from day one in 2017. So there's three different ways of doing it there in Hearts, then St Mirren, and then Motherwell. And since then, a couple of other clubs have been exploring it. One is at Partick Thistle. So Colin Weir, who the EuroMillions winner, who bought into state to Partick Thistle,
That's the
probably.
dream, isn't it?
Yeah, 5 to 10 years. Yeah, how many people say if I won the lottery, I'd buy my club? He actually didn't. So he won the EuroMillions. He bought a stake in the club, and invested in the youth academy, and invested in a lot of things behind the scenes. He had a terminal illness, and he went from being in relatively good health to passing away within the space of last year. Certainly, it wasn't publicly known before then. One of the last things he did before he passed away was to transfer his shareholding into a company that would eventually transfer it to the fans. And when he was still alive, he said, I'll give you the next 6 months to figure out how you want to do it. So you got 6 months to work it all out. 6 weeks later, he was no longer around, and then pandemic hit. So that one, it hasn't proceeded at the pace that it was going to, but his shares are effectively held in a company whose purpose is to eventually, put it into some form of community ownership, and it's for the Partick Thistle fans and community to work out exactly how that is structured and how that works. So they're working on that just now. The one after that is a Greig Morton. So the Greig Morton's been family owned for by the Ray family for probably 2 or 3 decades. Not sure exactly how long. And the family decided that, they've been underwriting debts, season on season, for a long period of time. The supporters actually made the proposition to the owning family that they would like to explore a similar model to Across the River in St Mirren, of supporter ownership. And the Ray family agreed that that was worth exploring. They brought them onto the board. They've made a commitment that if the fans can raise a certain amount of money by a certain date, then the family will cancel its debt, the club's debt to the family. So I mean, effectively, the supporters have to raise, I think, is around about £500,000, and
Oh, right,
if
okay.
they're able to do that, the family will wipe out more than £2 million of debt. So it's a great deal for the club. The
Yeah.
family will retain the stadium, but the club itself can then transition into supporter ownership, and they've done that, and they have a representative. The fans have a representative in the board of directors, again getting experience of what it's going to take to run the club, develop the business plan for how to keep it sustainable and not require somebody to dig into deep pockets every season as it has been doing for a good period of time. So that's, I mean, that's the five principally in Scotland that are in that model. The interesting part of that is, three of them are in the Premier Division already. And Partick Thistle are a big club. They're currently in League One after the early curtailment of last season. So they unfortunately went down to League One from the Championship. And I think they're in third place just now. But they're a big club who are typically in the Championship or the Premiership. Greig Morton are one of these archetypal, they're probably in the second tier most of the time. They have brief periods where they're good enough to go up to the top division. They have occasional, times when things aren't going quite so well and they slip down to the third tier. But this is five clubs in the top two divisions of Scotland, and that's something that's really notable in what's happened, because I think previously, as well as being thought of as owners of last resort, it was also seen as something that would only really work in League One or League Two. for the wee clubs, the part-time players, and very much a smaller operation. Whereas Hearts, Motherwell, St Mirren have proved it's possible in the top division.
Well, that's it. I mean, I'm listening. It's really interesting because, I'm listening as you talk about these different situations at these different clubs, and everything that they're going through or have gone through can all be sort of, be under this umbrella term of this structured transition. But it's interesting that it's also very much down to the circumstances that the club's in, that, how developed, if you like, the supporters' trust or group is, what the owner's circumstances are. So it's interesting that, there can be significantly different circumstances, but it can work. Not just one way it has to be done and that's it,
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the only thing that's consistent between all five of these is the level of trust and the level of credibility that the fans' organisations have. If they have that credibility, if they have experience, if they've already got a good relationship, or at least a working relationship with somebody with the wherewithal to make it happen, then they can do it any way they want. It can take any form. It can go over any timeline. And it's, if you've got the trust there, you can make these arrangements in place and hold each other to account on it. So that's the bit that you do need to have. Everything else is really open for negotiation or the creativity and to figure out what's right for the club.
And it's interesting as well that it leads quite nicely into the next question. What you said about these are clubs that are all in or around the top two divisions in the country, and it's good to see that in Scotland something's happening where more it's being seen as a credible venture or avenue for clubs to go down. And the next question I wanted to ask Alan is, do you think there is something inherent to Scottish football that uniquely places it to this method of converting football clubs to supporter ownership? Is there something about Scottish football, the landscape, that perhaps is fertile ground?
I think there's a few things actually. I mean, the first one is just the numbers that are involved. Most of our clubs it's a relatively achievable goal to have, to say, we could collectively own this. I think in the English Premiership, if you look at teams that are spending, 18, 90 million on a player or several players for that those sorts of price bands every summer, there's massive amounts of money flowing around English football in the top flight, and even in the second or third tiers, it dwarfs the kind of money that's in most of the Scottish game. So I think that's one thing, that it's an achievable target to reach. I think the second thing is that we have a lot of football clubs in Scotland. We have 42 professional clubs for a country of less than 6 million people. Every large town has a professional football club in it. So the clubs are closer to their community, by and large. So I think just the number of clubs that we have means most clubs are smaller. So and the average attendance, even in the... For clubs towards the, actually in the Championship, most clubs have an attendance of around 2,000 to 5,000 fans at the second tier of our game. So actually, they're not operating on this financial landscape that makes it a massive target. So we have lots and lots of medium sized or small clubs that make it more achievable to do it. I think the last thing, and this might sound quite political, but by its very nature, Scotland is quite a collectivist country. We're left to centre on most things, generally. Not everybody, obviously. There's people with different opinions, different beliefs, different political perspectives. But generally, we have a lot of people that believe in collectivism and collective ownership. A long history going back generations of trade unionism, and a lot of the principles in that are the same as acting together for the common good. And that just gives you a different idea of what might be possible and a different idea of what's normal. So it's normal for people to come together and do things together. So I think, and that's just my personal political perspective, that that's significant to Scotland. Others might disagree with me. They might just kind of dismiss me as a rabid lefty. I think people actually have a better balance between between capitalism and collectivism, if you like. They know, and even people who have made a lot of money, who have got the wherewithal to basically run a club themselves, actually see it as a realistic possibility to put that into collective ownership. So Anne Budge, although she could keep on running Hearts for the rest of time on her own, she's probably got deep enough pockets, and Gordon Scott could probably do it at St Mirren, and the guys that were involved at Motherwell before, they could continue to do that there. Actually, they see it as, well, why not a collective approach to it, a community ownership model? So that's one of those balances that I think makes it possible. But I don't think that's unique to Scotland at all. I think there are plenty of people with money and who've been successful financially who believe in collectivism and collective ownership and so on. So it's probably the size of the club that is probably the most significant thing that's in there. But again, coming back to what I said before, even in Scotland, people used to think it was for, with no disrespect, clubs the likes of Stirling Albion and Clyde. People never really thought this would be possible at a club like Hearts, who are massive in Scottish football terms. If you look at their season ticket holders and their average crowds, they're in the top five, biggest clubs in Scotland. Sometimes they're the third biggest. Sometimes maybe they slip down to the fourth or fifth, but they've always been one of our biggest clubs in Scotland. So I don't think people really thought it was possible there, but it is in a country like Scotland because of those different factors, I think.
That's really interesting, actually. The number of points that you say there. So, again, it leads quite nicely into the next question. What do you think have been the sort of standout benefits from going down this route into, fan ownership, where that there is this transition as opposed to sort of, waiting for the inevitable? And, have you sort of observed any sort of challenges or side effects that clubs and their supporters trusts have had to negotiate going down this path?
The advantages first. I mean, the advantages is it gives people a good look at each other and at the club. So it allows you a prolonged period of due diligence, and to put it on those terms, but it also allows the owner to really see the credibility of the supporters group. See, these aren't bampots that are calling for the manager's head at every turn, and that are only interested in how many goals they put past the opposition on Derby Day. They're calm, sensible, credible people, and also they have a lot of skill and experience within their ranks. So I think, and it also gives the fans an opportunity to work alongside the owner and just to see what the pressures are, to see the difficult decisions that have to be made in order to balance all the competing priorities of kind of balancing the books, competing on the park, investing in the future and the rest of it. So they get to see the owners as real people, rather than these kind of one-dimensional or maybe two-dimensional figures, sometimes ogres, sometimes white knights, whatever. None of those things are true. Most owners aren't ogres, most owners aren't white knights, most of them are somewhere in between. So you get to see the nuance of it, and you get a real good look at the club, so you know exactly what it's going to take to run it. What contingencies you need in place. You know how you balance those competing priorities yourself when it's finally your time to do it. So that's the biggest advantage, and it's building that credibility and experience. The challenges are around maintaining people's enthusiasm for it. So it's when you're deep in crisis, it's easy to motivate people to put their hands in their pockets to help out. When you're 7 or 8 years into that handover period, it's not as exciting as it was at the start. And actually keeping your membership levels up and keeping your financial contributions up, that's a challenge, and you have to work hard at it. Again, there's an advantage to that because you're going to have to work hard at that, for the rest of time. So it allows you to kind of really set that kind of expectation that we're going to be fan-owned. We don't have deep pockets. We don't have, a spare 3 million down the back of the sofa to buy a centre forward in the January transfer window. In order for us to compete and to be able to react to changes, we're going to need to build up a buffer of contributions from members. So you can turn it into an advantage if you campaign the right way. And that's what the clubs in Scotland who've done that have found out. And they've been relatively successful at doing that and not had the drop-offs in member contributions that they maybe expected when they started off. But it's something that they have to really work hard at because it's a very different proposition to keep on paying your direct debit years later. As it is when you're almost losing your club and your club is at death's door. So but and that's the bit, but it kind of it has you take it serious. It professionalizes you, and it has you making everything really, really robust so that you're ready to take over the club and for it to work.
That's it. Yeah, I think, it's that, once a club does get over that line, or, as you say, get these continuous direct debits or whatever, it's maintaining that almost sort of perpetuation, if that's the correct word, just to keep it constantly, turning with contribution from members and supporters. I think that's the challenge, no matter how big or small the supporter owned club is. We're on to the penultimate question now,
Okay.
Alan. Sort of viewing the situation in Scotland externally, it does seem that more clubs are turning to supporter ownership each year. Is this the case? And is there anything in particular that you think has catalyzed this? And again, I wonder if it goes back to what you were talking about the size of clubs and the money involved is more achievable. But
Well, I'm not sure that it is increasing year on year. It's quite steady progress. I think there was probably a surge of interest in the idea back when Sports Direct was formed back 20 years ago, or actually it's more than 20 years now. There was a surge of interest in it, Supporters Trust setting up with an aspiration to do that. I think we've had, if you actually look at the five examples I've talked about today, it's more or less one per year starts. And that's a fairly steady drip rate. I think what's happening is it's certainly increasing the numbers of big clubs that are looking at it. Clubs in those top two divisions. That's quite a new thing, and that's a bit of a surge of interest in it. So I think the thing that's behind that, the thing that's catalyzed it, is owners of football clubs talking to each other on match days in the boardroom. So any club that goes and visits St Mirren and is entertained and sees how professionally the club is run and sees a supporter director in the boardroom talking about what's happening and what their aspirations are, seeing the improvements that they've made to the club in the meantime, and the same will happen at Hearts, same will happen at Motherwell. Then those visiting directors, owners will say, will have it in their head that it's something that might work for them. And it's something I've heard from supporter directors at some of those clubs. They've said there's more conversations about it on Saturday afternoon in the boardroom now. Visiting directors ask, just what's that all about? And people who would dismiss it as absolutely, I was going to swear there, but I remember you've got a beat machine as a crazy idea. People who would previously dismiss it as a crazy idea that has no chance of ever working actually can see for themselves that it is working. And I think those conversations about legacy, and we've been very deliberate the way that we talk about this. We say this is an opportunity for you to ensure that the good work that you've done continues. That's a very different perspective coming from us than maybe they're expecting to come from organisations like Supporters Direct Scotland. They probably think we see them as the bad guy, and that we're always super critical and super suspicious of everything they do. And that's still true. We are suspicious of everything anybody does, and I think it's probably more cautious than suspicion. But actually, when we talk about it as so, this is the way for you to continue to make sure the good work you're doing continues. That maybe takes them by surprise a little bit. So we have a more open conversation with owners of football clubs now than we maybe used to in the past because they don't see us as the people who are demonising them, who are criticising everything that they do, that are dismissing them, and that want to start a revolution. We want to start an evolution, not a revolution. And the clubs are doing it, and the clubs are proving that that's the way to do it. And what any good owner of a football club wants is the club to be left in good hands. They don't. They're generally putting in money hand over fist every year that they're running the club, and they don't want that money to be wasted. So they want somebody to look after what they've done after they've gone. And it's only the bad owners that would disagree with that. Unfortunately, we don't have too many like that in Scotland anymore.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and I think you probably make a good point there, actually. obviously they'll hear, this and that, perhaps through media or whatever, these owners of clubs, about supporter ownership. But it probably is those conversations in boardrooms at, on match days. And if they hear it from, a colleague, essentially somebody that they would see as quite credible, saying, do you know what, this is actually all right. Maybe that's what starts turning the cogs in their thought process.
People are always more open to learn from their peers. So owners are more likely to listen to and learn from and try to adapt what a fellow owner has done. Fans groups are more likely to listen and learn and hear and adapt to what other fans groups have done. They probably have the critical ears on when they're hearing what a traditional owner wants to do. It's actually just building those connections. So it's a very natural thing to happen there. But it's a conversation behind closed doors where they can ask the difficult questions. And it's information that will be shared behind those closed doors that probably wouldn't be made public, so they get a real close look at it, and they see that these supporters that are coming in to sit on the boards are not dafties. They're not ranting, raving. Well, some of them do rant and rave, but so do some of the traditional owners. But mostly they're very well qualified, very very well experienced, competent, careful, thoughtful, good people. So they can see that for themselves and think, well, yeah, we've got. I'm sure we've got some people that some fans that aren't complete bamboos.
That's it. So we're on to the final question now, Alan. So looking more broadly, there is even a campaign by supporters of Celtic to try and gain shares in the football club. Do you think the future of Scottish football is fan-owned?
I think the
that's
future
a broad
Scottish,
one.
I think the future of Scottish football is for fan ownership to be the norm rather than the exception. We'll probably never get there for every club unless we had something like the 50+1 rule come in that forced everybody to do it. It would have to come in probably beyond just Scotland, because Celtic, you mentioned in your question, Rangers as well, Aberdeen, they have ambitions to compete in European football. Other clubs do as well. No, I'm not saying they're the only three, but Celtic and Rangers particularly, they operate with much bigger numbers than the rest of Scottish football, and there's a handful of clubs that are the next tier down that are there's lots more money flowing through them than the majority of Scottish football clubs. But certainly for our biggest clubs, in order for them to continue to compete in European competitions, if they have realistic ambitions to get to the knockout stages of the Champions League more often than once in a blue moon, that's a big step to make under fan ownership. And we don't have the money coming into our game through broadcast deals in Scotland that would allow them to do anything other than either rely on money coming in through the turnstiles or benefactors or lending or borrowing. So we absolutely can't rule that out, because that is how a lot of clubs are able to compete, by borrowing from tomorrow. But I certainly think that the future of Scottish football, in fact, the present of Scottish football, has got more fan ownership in it than it used to. And I think in the over the next couple of decades, we'll see more clubs going down this route, and it will actually feel like the right thing and a very natural thing for clubs to do.
I think what you said there, I like there's sort of a sentence you said there, and I think you said for fan ownership to be the norm, not the exception. And I think, in Scottish football, across Europe as well, obviously you've got countries with the 50+1 rule, but to just see more clubs that are owned by their fans would be great.
I think in Scotland as well, so particularly in the lower divisions in Scotland, the clubs effectively are owned by their fans. They're just owned by individual fans rather than fans collectively. So, they'll have, 6 or 10 local businessmen, fans of the club, who have decided that that they're going to be custodians for the club for future generations. But they do it through individual shareholdings, through a collective, that rather than a collective shareholding. Mm. And I think it's quite a small step to go from one to the other. And actually, making the argument for it is actually more difficult, because they say, well, why? How is that different from what we're already doing? So, and the only thing that's really different is the democratic decision making. You're giving everybody a vote rather than giving those 8 people or 10 people a vote. But actually, the money's coming from fans. It's just coming from a small number of fans, And they operate, with the numbers so low and the numbers of people so low that they're actually much closer to the community already. So it's a way of formalizing it and saying, well, actually, if we can demonstrate the advantage of collective decision making, and I don't mean who picks the team on Saturdays is decided by the people in the terracing. That's never the model, and it's something that Hearts in particular have done a very good job of. They stress that our goal is not to be fan run, it's to be fan owned. It will still be professionally run, and I think making that case and can just saying so there's collective ownership and there's democratic decision making on some things, but it's not on every decision that has to be made. You still have a boardroom of people who are qualified to make decisions and to do it, but they're answerable to the wider support. That's really the only difference that you need to make there.
Well, superb, Alan. That was great. Thanks. That's my last question. So, job done. Yeah.
Good.
That was brilliant. Thank you. I really appreciate your time going through those with me. So that was the end of the podcast for this episode. We'd like to say a massive thank you to Alan and his colleagues at SD Scotland for giving us an insight into this. For anybody listening that would like to learn more about Supporters Direct Scotland, you can visit their website, which is www.supporters-direct.com. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. To find out more information about SD Europe, head to www.sdeurope.eu.